Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Richard Maurer of the Alaska Dispatch News and Lisa Diemer of the same news organization. Richard, Alaska Natives accuse the state of failing to adequately meet the needs of Native voters in parts of rural Alaska. The plaintiffs were in federal court. You saw the trial before Judge Sharon Gleason here in Anchorage. Summarize what you saw, the outstanding elements.
Well, the main issues are, did the state adequately provide language assistance to people who speak Yupik and people who speak Gwich'in, Yupik speakers in the Bethel area, the broad Bethel area, and Gwich'in in Arctic Village and Venati, that area, interior. And the contention was that the voters were not, especially elder voters, voters who grew up at a time when there weren't sophisticated village schools, the schools ended in eighth grade, people who took further education had to go outside their villages to boarding schools. So there's certainly the people of my age did not get a lot of education in English. And so the question is, should the state, under federal law, should the state have provided adequate translations of not just the ballot, not just the instructions for how to vote absentee, but the whole broad range of voting materials that I get in English, the pamphlet, the time to vote, all those kinds of things.
Candidate statements, I believe.
Candidate statements and the pamphlet, and should they be in written Gwich'in, in written Yupik, which is basically a written language that's existed only for, in the case of Yupik, the current orthography, as they say, is only about 50 years old. So there are a lot of people who, for whom the language is just an oral language, and the state says, why should we provide written materials in a language that is essentially oral? The assertion of the plaintiffs was, if you translate it, the people who can read the language will read it, and the people who are who can't read in either English or Yupik, at least they will get the benefit of a consistent, someone could read this to them, a poll worker can read the language, they'll get a consistent translation of these materials.
And they have the poll workers, and they have these special outreach workers. I think only actually worked, wasn't it testified to, like 5 hours of election.
Hours of training and five hours of work, and for the outreach workers. And a lot of times people wouldn't show up for the training. Sometimes outreach workers wouldn't show up. So there's a question of, was there an adequate effort? And it's going to be up to the judge to say yes or no.
And Gail Fanumiai of the Division of Elections, the director, represented the state. There were others as well, mm-hmm. but she testified at some length about how the state conducts itself and what they are doing and their outreach and so forth.
Right, she's one of the defendants in the case, and so definitely had a lot to do with the defense of the state. And what basically the state is saying, all we have to do is provide effective translations, effective language assistance.
Yeah, that came up in the final arguments. The state's lawyer argued that point specifically. Not perfect, not ideal, not utopian, but effective.
But effective, and the case the plaintiffs made was that this isn't effective, and that the proof is that voters don't turn out in the numbers that you would expect them to in these precincts.
And if we might have one example of the translation problems, Oscar Alexi, who was a professor of Yupik at the Kuskokwim Community College, mm-hmm. was one of the witnesses for the state, and he talked about the difficulties of translating and talked about the big headache.
It is a big headache, because when you think about it, I mean, this is a language that grew up for people whose subsistence way of life was the most important, was the way you survive, and you had to be doing things constantly to survive because of the harsh climate. And now all of a sudden coming in with words for election, with words for oil tax, with words for lobbyist, this is not the simplest thing you could imagine.
Yeah, they had quite a bit of trouble on the word lobbyist. I believe it was suggested to him, it's somebody who takes care of you. And he thought the lobbyists were not taking care of him.
Which may be appropriate, but I think they take care, they maybe it's argued that they take care of the legislators more than the people who they represent.
Right, right. Lisa, shopping may never be the same in Bethel, at least shopping for groceries. You visited the new Swanson's in Bethel, their new, the big new store there, or the improved store. What did you find?
It was fairly amazing for Bethel, and to appreciate the new Swanson's, you really had to have been in the old Swanson's, so I'll just start with that. And as a visitor to Bethel, to go into the old Swanson's, to me, it was an experience and just kind of fun because it was so funky, so quirky. Very hard to find things, you know, a maze of aisles, the floors were crooked, the ceiling leaked. The prices were high, and they had just interesting things for sale, you know, mosquito nets, funeral arrangements, just things you don't find in the grocery store, usually in big displays in Anchorage.
They put the general store, it sounds like.
True. But, you know, interesting. And the new Swanson's, though, for people who live in Bethel, for shoppers there, is, you know, it might be life-changing. You go in, the first thing we saw was this huge indoor specially made charcoal grill where they were grilling ribs. Next to it was like the Asian takeout counter. They have these special salads. They have a huge organic section. I forget how many shelf feet, but a lot of shelf feet. They have specially designed produce section with shelves that are lower so you don't have to stack things so high where they might spoil. The exact right temperatures, all specially designed. They've got bulk bins. It goes on and on. It's, you know, it's actually, it's beautiful inside. Eating areas, etc. And a movie theater with two screens. Also,
And Costco has a presence. Explain that.
Yeah, there's aisles. This just kind of struck me. There are aisles and they're marked Costco, Costco, Costco. And you go down them and it's full of Kirkland bulk products, you know, giant coffee, giant boxes of coffee, you know, gallon mayonnaise, three packs of ketchup, etc. The prices still are high. Along with the Swanson's new store, what had been the main grocery in town, the AC store, it's spiffed up too. It's added organic, it's added new sections, and it's added bulk goods. I asked both stores about whether there was going to be grocery wars, price wars, and the AC store's response was, "We hope not." But they've actually been running some ads and some pretty steep discounts, trying to make sure people.
One of the things
still
I've seen in other parts of the country where you get these grocery wars is one of the businesses, or perhaps both of them, will have ATM machines in which they don't charge. So they tell you, it's your money, come in and you know, we won't charge you $3. I don't know if that's...
Actually, at Swanson's, the ATM machine was not yet functioning on opening day, so I'm not sure of the status of that. But
okay.
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Costco showed up in Anchorage. You know, that was in the 80s, and that was such a big event here that people... We're genuinely...
And I assume that for both of you, the people in Oscarville or some vision, Napaskiak, they can be like they're going to, people in Bethel going to Anchorage. Mm. They go to Bethel and have this big shopping event and put it in their boat and down the river they go.
That's what they said, and they do, and they can pull up right on the riverbank, right behind the new Swanson's, park their boats, walk up a small hill, and they do that and buy in bulk and go back down and boat away to home.
Is there a sign that says no shopping carts? Don't take your shopping cart in the boat?
No, but I was surprised. At least the first week, there were no shopping carts left at the where the boats are parked down there in the muddy bank, and I was a little surprised by that. I thought that would be easier, but everyone just seemed to be hefting it down on their backs.
Okay, the Alaska Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, in a surprise, endorses Dan Sullivan for the U.S. Senate in the Republican primary and more generally in the general election. And then one of the board members, Eugene Brower, cries foul. What happened? I'm going to talk about this a little bit. This is, first of all, the things that stand out about this, it was a surprise that they would take this active role in the election. And this is, after all, a corporation. It's not the local government. in some ways, it might be, as somebody reminded me, it'd be sort of like Exxon or a bank in Anchorage coming out in a general election and saying who they endorse, because it is a business. Apparently, the members of the board were polled, and a majority were for Sullivan. And now Eugene Brower, Democrat and heavily involved in local politics, is objecting and wants to know why this all happened. Why they made this change? A spokesman for the board said Sullivan was the best candidate. The way I saw it in print was that and other versions was that the members of the board were polled. I originally thought that they would have all been in the same room and they took a vote and it was 6-4. 5-3 or 8-1 or something like that, if in voting. I sort of wonder what Mark Begich would do, what his response would be, and it seems like the obvious thing is he probably called up Eugene Brower and asked him to explain it to him about what was going on up there, and I sort of wondered if he would call up the board members who voted against him and say, I'd really like to understand what have I done to fail you? What have I done that just hasn't worked out for you that you're going to make this change? You want to make this change in personnel? And I would think for any corporation, it's something of a risk to come out against an incumbent U.S. senator who probably has control over several bills that you want. I also took a look at the 2008 primary and general election results where Ted Stevens and Mark Begich were competing for the U.S. Senate. And I was a little surprised at how big Begich's margin was. It was quite big in both the primary and general election. So this tends to be Democratic territory. Democrats, registered Democrats, who are about 25% of the voters in House District 40, won't be able to vote in the primary unless they change their registration. So they're going to be competing for that other 75% in the primary. And the question would be, how many of them could Dan Sullivan round up? We'll just have to wait and see. Lisa, continuing with the Senate race, Republican challenger Sullivan and Mark Begich are exchanging hostile advertisements. I see most of them on my computer rather than on television. It seems like every time I turn it on, they're there. What are the two saying, and why is Begich or Sullivan focusing on Begich when he still has to win a primary?
Well, it's relentless, these ads. So far, there's been about $25 million committed to ads in Alaska on the Senate race, and that's counting the super PAC money. And that's more than in any other state. And so, I mean, obviously, Alaska is a major state here for this Senate fight for the Republicans trying to regain control of the U.S. Senate. But Sullivan, you know, he's said all along he's not going to go after his primary opponents. He's focusing on Begich, and he's making himself out as the front runner. And maybe some ways he is. He's leading the Republicans with money for certain, and so he's making it him versus Begich, kind of ignoring the other two. Now, whether that's going to work out to be totally in his favor, as you're saying, we'll see, because Begich and the super PAC, Put Alaska First, that's working on his behalf, are taking aim at Sullivan. Meanwhile, Mead Treadwell doesn't have to get in the middle of that fight. They're saying, I mean, the ads are on everything you can imagine. There's a lot that are going on around hunting and gun rights. They're each trying to make out that the other is weak on gun rights. The Put Alaska First approach is to say that the controversial legislation that didn't get through
House Bill 77,
that it was about taking away, in some version, gun rights. That wasn't explicitly in the legislation at all, and some dispute that could have happened, but there could have been tie-up of land with some of the provisions in there that could have affected certainly fishing and perhaps gun rights. So at any rate, there's a lot of ads around who is for gun rights. There's a new round along those lines, and Sullivan has come out with one featuring Elena Spraker, whose husband's the chair of the state game board, and she says Dan Sullivan is for protecting the rights. The other side's got one featuring Beth Nordlund with Parks Group, and she's saying he's threatening access to land. And so it just goes on. And there have been ads have aired more than 20,000 times already.
Can I ask Richard a question at this point? Richard, what do you suppose the rate of return is for something that's been shown 20,000 times? I sort of wonder if the public says, I've seen this before, or tunes it out, but they wouldn't put this on if they didn't think it worked.
I don't know. How many times have you seen the Pepsi commercial?
That's a good answer.
And all you just need is a jingle that you can hum, and everything's good. So I don't know. But certainly what Dan Sullivan has been trying to do is try and portray himself as the inevitable candidate.
Yeah.
And whether indeed he is, Mee Treadwell would have an objection to that, and certainly Joe Miller would too. So.
And on Mee Treadwell, he's got a 60-second web ad out, and he's got a 30-second version of it running TV and radio, and it's not attacking anyone. It's basically talking about himself as the, he says, true conservative.
Okay. Richard, Congressman Don Young receives a letter of reproval from the House Ethics Committee. What is the nature of this kind of letter, and what did he do wrong?
I had to look up what reproval meant, and
on spell check, it shows up as not a word.
That's right. It's a problem, and I think it goes back to something about what you do to a person in your congregation if you're mad at them about something.
Stuart England.
It's basically shaking your finger at them and saying bad boy. Something other. The fact is this appears to be the close of an investigation that's been known about since at least 2006. And it's a small, very small part of what the FBI had been looking into Don Young about. It's all about 25 trips that he took on someone else's dime, or at least a portion of it, 15 of which the Ethics Committee ruled that that were at least partially wrong and said, you did a bad thing, you shouldn't do it again. And pay back the people who paid your way, which whether it's your campaign or the rich guys who flew you there, and it's all these were all basically to so-called hunting lodges, places, game farms, places where game was fenced off, exotic species that you drove around and pick up trucks, and someone pointed it's over there, and you get out and you shoot it. And then you get a taxidermist to mount the head or whatever you're going to be. There's some taxidermy bills in there as well. And Don Young's always made a point. You go into his office in D.C. and there's heads everywhere. There's skins, there's pellets, there's all kinds of things. It looks like a hunting lodge itself. And occasionally he's been absent from duty, and you say, where you been? And I've been out hunting. So you sort of think of Don Young being the great hunter, and I'm sure he's experienced hunting like I have, which is tromping around and fighting mosquitoes and getting your feet soaked.
Getting wet.
Yeah, getting your feet soaked. But I've never hunted from a pickup truck.
And up here it'd be illegal, not always, but if you were certainly on a state road. Okay, Lisa. Veteran reporter Bob Takacs, who was a fixture in the Capitol for many years, died. We talked about Bob just briefly on a previous show, but you were exposed to him, and perhaps you could tell us a little more.
I just wanted to mention about him. They had memorials yesterday or Thursday for Bob in Juneau, including one in the House Speaker's chambers. To those of us who knew Bob, it's kind of remarkable. He was, people used a lot of terms about him. I mean, he's a bulldog, he's a fighter. But he didn't put up with it from politicians, but also from his fellow journalists, which is something that probably most people wouldn't realize. I mean, he called us spineless. He was disgusted with most reporters a lot of the time. But in the end, everyone appreciated him because he always called it out. He always said it like he thought it. And there were other elements to him. I mean, he hosted a jazz show in Juneau. He loved jazz. He loved China. He traveled to Asia.
And he was an experienced fisheries reporter.
He wrote about fisheries. He had Laws of the Sea. I brought with me, I think it's 30-something pages. They did a special memorial version of Laws for the Sea for his memorial. And on the front of it, there was this little sticky note that was on his desk, and it says, be a good person today.
pretty wonderful. Thank you very much. Okay, I was going to add here, Joe Miller goes after his Republican Senate candidates, rivals, over the issue of immigration. And it's pretty clear he's trying to drive a wedge between them and himself, as he is the true stand-up patriot on immigration. So he is essentially blaming Mead Treadwell and Sullivan, Dan Sullivan, as being sort of weak on immigration, and also, of course, going after Barack Obama. That would be expected. Miller was pretty good in presenting himself. I mean, it was very intense the way he presents himself, but he made the case that he wants to make. I'm just not sure how much of an audience there is here in Alaska for that issue, given how far we are from the border, or how many people would change their mind based on that one issue. In attempting to portray Treadwell and company as wishy-washy, I sort of wondered, you know, it was sort of Miller expressing his views intensely, articulately, but you sort of wonder how much opportunity there is to turn around the electorate in that, given that both of them are conservative Republicans.
Well, it's certainly a red meat issue for a lot of the Tea Party folks.
And maybe that's where he'd be wanting to fire up people who might not otherwise vote, who could vote for him.
Right, he needs his base. He needs to activate the base, and that's one way to do it, because that is a red meat issue for a certain segment, regardless of whether they live in Alaska or Texas.
And this is also something he's put on the web and talked to the Daily News about. So you could do, this is a good example of what you can do pretty quickly without having a television crew right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Richard, once more, legislators approve a $500,000 furniture budget for a new Anchorage office building. We all have watched construction of the refurbished office building downtown on 4th Avenue. Now we know some of what's going to go into it.
Right, and if you... Obviously, this is a super hot potato, and so what the legislators decided for themselves was that they're just going to get the used furniture, the old furniture, all stacked up in the warehouses. And there are pictures in this report that's out there. It just shows these leather sofas standing on their ends, and those will get moved into the legislator's office. They're going to buy furniture for their staff. The idea being that they're going to make it modular, so that when a legislator, say, takes Lisa McGuire, who comes in as a freshman, and next thing you know, she's rules chairwoman, and she gets a big new office, and everyone moves to the new office, the staff won't have to move their stuff, because the stuff in the new office will be the same as the stuff in the old office.
Oh, they'll just move the contents of the desks.
Right, and themselves.
Yeah, themselves.
And get the view out the window that they may not have had as a freshman.
In the basement.
Wherever, or as a Democrat, wherever you stick the people who don't get the perks. So yeah, and you know, whereas the $500,000 budget is significantly more than the $100,000 recommended by their own subcommittee, but significantly less than the $900,000 or so recommended or suggested by the architect. So the people in charge, in particular Representative Mike Hawker, is saying that we're being economical, and the people who oppose it are still saying this is the Taj Mahawker.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, and worthy of elephants and marble, I guess.
Well, and it seems like this is always something that's hard to explain to the public, whether it's improvements to the Capitol or the office building here in Anchorage. Driving down 4th Avenue, the cab driver will say to you, look at that, wasting all that money just apropos of it's happening. And then you have headlines about furniture, and I suppose it's hard to convince when you're improving your physical surrounding, you're not just doing it for your own convenience.
Well, the question is, do you really need glass elevators in this building? Do you need the kind of improvements that this is going to have, or should you just have a government building? You know, you look at a typical federal building or a typical county courthouse elsewhere in the world, and they're pretty much, you know, 1930s practicality. And the question is that what this is? Or not? Or you go to the state capitol. The state capitol in Juneau.
Oh, I got one final thing for you here. Is there a bunch of money going into security measures at this building or not?
That I don't know. I don't know if there'll be a sign saying "Leave your handguns outside," as there is in the capitol. The legislators are for guns everywhere except in their own building. And of course, then there's the other news is Wes Keller getting busted for shipping bullets for his handgun.
We'll have to come back to that. Lisa, Dip Knitting opened yesterday on the mouth of the Kenai. We have about 1 minute to give us the summary of what we know right now.
Well, they're probably expecting big crowds this weekend for that. There's a lot of red salmon that have actually already come into the Kenai River, about 150,000 so far. It's more than fish managers actually want to see at this point. So they've got this difficult call to make of, do you allow commercial set netters who can affect dip netting to go out on Saturday as well? And so they're grappling with that question on Friday afternoon, and they'll figure out something Friday afternoon or evening and put out an announcement about that. But they are expecting a lot of folks out there. Whether there'll be a lot of salmon at this point in the run is yet to be seen, because it's still a little bit early for the biggest surge.
And as we know, what do newspapers love and television love? Nice young man, or especially a child with a big salmon. Thank you very much for joining us, my guests, and thank you, viewers and listeners, for being with us. We'll see you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.